Hi, it's Patrick here, and I'm speaking English today. Only English. And apropos of that, well, someone's got to laugh at that joke. So today, a Tea Party update on the movement to make English the official language of the United States. It's popular with politicians and the public, but is it needed? Also, the art of human translation wins out big time in post-quake Japan, a place where pain and hope and some incredible stories are told in simple, direct terms on Twitter.
That is exactly why I wanted to translate these tweets coming directly from people in Japan. It's something unfiltered. Well, obviously filtered by us translators in a way, but other than that, it's totally direct. And I think this is what kind of gives me passion as a translator.
That and a new satire show on Egyptian TV.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. New words, old words, censoring everything.
The World in Words podcast and The World Radio Program, The Big Show, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, The Big Show is at theworld.org. The pod is at theworld.org/language. Also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. I tweet a bunch of language stories, most of which I don't get to in this podcast. There's also a Facebook page called, surprise, surprise, The World in Words. That's a good place to post your comments about what you've heard and send info about what you might want to hear in future podcasts. So today, the English-only movement, it's back, now with added caffeine provided by the Tea Partiers. Also, a Japanese translator talks about volunteering to translate tweets out of Japan in the days and weeks after the earthquake and tsunami. And if you happen to have heard that interview originally in The Big Show, what I'm going to play today is a longer version. Then on to something that's changed as a result of the so-called Arab Spring, which I guess is soon going to be, what, the Arab Summer? Spring Summer? I don't know. And that is TV satire in Egypt and the inevitable comparison to Jon Stewart. So first, the state of official English. Why, as the woman says at the top of the show, as an American, does she have to push a button to speak English? This strikes me as an odd observation. As an American, doesn't she want choice? Doesn't she want 24 flavors? Well, the answer is no. She wants English, and she's not alone. The thing is, this is a question that's come up again and again and again in American political life, dating all the way back to the 18th century, minus, of course, in those days, the phone technology. And this question is still very much being asked, and cities and states across the United States are still passing laws based on what they think the answer to that question is. Here's a report that I did for The Big Show earlier this week.
If you don't speak English and have recently settled in the U.S., there's a good chance you'll be able to keep up with the news. This Spanish-language news station out of Oklahoma City makes it easier for Spanish speakers to stay in touch with what's going on. You can also shop in Spanish, put your kid in Spanish-language daycare, and, of course, push a button on the phone. Tim Schultz of the advocacy group US English says all this is eventually going to lead to a divided nation.
What realistically will happen by the sort of elevation of Spanish to this sort of co-official status is not that everybody would suddenly become bilingual, it's that Spanish speakers less and less need to learn English to survive in the United States. And that creates a sort of second mainstream, if you will, a second linguistic mainstream.
Schultz's group was behind a referendum in Oklahoma last November in which 76% of voters approved making English the official language of the state. Among other things, you can no longer take a driver's test in Spanish. In all, 31 states have official English laws, ranging from the purely symbolic to the concrete, like bans on government employees issuing documents in foreign languages. In poll after poll, support for making English the official language of the United States is overwhelming, usually above 80%. Every year, an English-only bill is introduced in Congress. For Tim Schultz, learning to speak English is something every immigrant should be encouraged to do, as part of, as he puts it, transferring your identity from your home country to the United States.
That's something that we've always, I think, asked for as a country. I think it's sort of been a bargain that for us to accept you, you have to accept certain of the things we do here, one of which is we have a common language. It's English.
The Tea Party movement has breathed fresh life into the English-only cause.
Hey, I can't read that sign out there. Please tell me what's it say.
This song, 14 million hits and counting on YouTube, is a favorite at Tea Party events.
Now we don't ask too much to share this land of liberties. But if it's not too much to ask, could you please speak English?
That message, of course, is largely ignored in places like Miami, a city where you can go an entire day without hearing a word of English. The foreign language you'll mainly hear is Spanish. Mainly. At this Miami public school that specializes in languages, the kids are learning math and science in German. German, of course, doesn't spark the kind of outrage that Spanish does. But it wasn't always that way. Robert Lane Green is the author of a new book about language and identity called You Are What You Speak.
200 and a bit years ago, Benjamin Franklin thought that there were so many Germans that German really clearly threatened to make America a bilingual country and was absolutely opposed to it. 100 years ago, during the great wave of immigration to the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, a brilliant man, I mean legitimately brilliant, said that America was becoming what he called a polyglot boarding house and that this was something unacceptable and needed to be stopped. Well, Ben Franklin was wrong about those Germans, and Teddy Roosevelt was wrong about that huge wave of immigrants, a much bigger wave, by the way, than we have today.
The wave today, nonetheless, is big. The U.S. Census Bureau puts the number of people here who speak Spanish at home at more than 34 million. That's twice as many as in 1990. But Green cites another stat. A study of people in Miami and San Diego showed that 94% of the children of immigrants spoke English well or very well by eighth grade. That's in line with the long-established pattern of language acquisition in the U.S. The first generation, the immigrant, tends not to pick up much English. The second generation, born in this country, learns English alongside their home language. And finally, the third generation learns only English. Green says that pattern continues today.
Even in places like Southern California, Southern Texas, Southern Florida, where we have these big concentrated populations, it would in theory be possible to live a pretty full life not speaking English by speaking only Spanish. But the fact is that parents don't tend to impose Spanish only on children because that would be borderline abusive. They know that English is the language of this country and they want their children to learn it so that they'll have every opportunity. The idea that there's some kind of sneaky political beachhead here that wants to colonize parts of the country for Spanish only is, I think, a figment of the imagination of some people rather than a real on-the-ground phenomenon.
That said, the state-by-state march toward English only continues. A bill seeking to make Texas the 32nd state to have English as the official language had a hearing this week. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
And if you want to hear more from either of the two people I interviewed in that story, they're both in earlier pods. I have an interview with Robert Lane Green in last week's pod, number 124. Also with Tim Schultz, the lobbyist for U.S. English. That's in number 107. In Japan, there's been an outpouring of emotion this past month. Many emotions, in fact. And most of them weren't translated. And that's because most of those emotions were expressed on the web. There was just so much material. Aya Watanabe noticed this. She's a professional translator. And for the past few weeks, she's been working with a Tokyo-based blogger who's been compiling some of the most poignant tweets out of Japan. She spoke with The Big Show's Marco Werman.
Aya Watanabe, what prompted you to do this in the first place, to translate these tweets?
I contacted this blogger, Gen Taguchi, the day after the earthquake hit. And I think it was the day when he started sending out these tweets. And it just touched my heart to the core. And I think I was one of the many, many people who have been so shocked and devastated. And we needed something to give us hope.
I mean, it's interesting. Twitter really became this almost indispensable communication device after the tsunami and earthquake. In fact, I read that Twitter use increased in just the few days after the earthquake by a third. That's enormous.
Oh, it is. And it's been really helpful to all of us. I was not in the affected area of Tohoku, but I was getting so much information out of tweets rather than any other media that I was able to reach.
Well, let's just pick a few of the tweets here. I mean, this first one that I saw was actually about Twitter. This writer says, I could not use phone and text message, but Twitter was just working. I believe it was much more useful than the specially installed phone number to contact people, the 171, which is their 911 version. I believe many retweets supported someone's heart, which is pretty extraordinary. And here's another one, which is also very poignant, not about Twitter. This is from a woman who was taking a mass transit. She says, transport facilities were dead, and I was so tired waiting so long. Then a homeless guy gave me a cardboard saying, use this, it can warm you up. I used to pass homeless people by even when they were begging, although what he did to me was such a sweet stuff. Really, really moving. Maybe you can tell us some of your favorite tweets.
Oh, sure. One of my favorites is one that had been posted quite recently, and it's called Mom's Pep Talk. It goes like this. I called my mom to let her know I survived the quakes. She lives in Kagoshima on Kyushu Island, 1,000 miles south of Tohoku. I thought she was worried about me and wanted to calm her down. Instead of tears, what I got from her was a pep talk. Son, know with all your heart the meaning of your being where you are at this timing and age in your life. Do the best you can to serve others. Mother, I am proud to be your son. I will live through all of this.
That is an incredible pep talk. I mean, it sounds like one of those pieces of life advice. Just on a practical matter, our listeners are going to say that's way more than 140 characters. But these are written in Japanese characters, so you can actually sum up a lot more things into a character, right?
Yes. And also, this is a tweet that I translated, and I added a few words like where Kagoshima is, because I just imagine that people who are reading this in English would not really know where Kagoshima is, and that the mother lived in a safe place, whereas the writer of this tweet did not.
Yeah, no, it's really helpful to have some of your annotations in this document of all these tweets you've translated. Share with us another one of your favorite tweets.
Oh, sure. There's another one, which is my favorite and one of the recent tweets, and it's about packing for a move. Would you like me to read it out?
Sure, packing for a move.
Yes. When I was packing for my move, my mother handed me a flashlight and survival food she had kept for the family, saying, take these and do not buy new ones. There are people who really need them now. Us? We are fine. We have family and our neighbors. We can help each other if a disaster strikes our area. You will be living by yourself, a stranger in a strange land. You have all the reasons to be anxious about your new life. No need to be anxious about us, your family. I felt so proud to be my mother's daughter, to be part of this family.
Mm. You know, there are many other stories in these tweets you've translated, things that strike me, like the families, the women who are cooking vats of miso soup, not for their families, but for other people, for the people in shelters. There seems to be such a big translation gulf between Japanese and English that's exposed at a time like this. I mean, there's so much we haven't grasped, but with these translated tweets, it feels less distant somehow.
I'm so happy to hear that, because that is exactly why I wanted to translate these tweets coming directly from people in Japan to really connect all of us, because it's something unfiltered. Well, obviously filtered by us translators in a way, but other than that, it's totally direct. And I think this is what kind of gives me passion as a translator.
Reading and hearing you read some of these tweets, I mean, even though these events have only happened a few weeks ago, it already feels like a moment in time that's passed, like a time capsule. Which seems to be kind of taking the lead right now, generosity and goodwill or frustration and impatience?
I think it's still both. Initially, I think there was more generosity. But yes, we have been seeing more impatience and frustration, and especially because of the nuclear threat.
Aya, how long are you going to keep translating these tweets coming out of Japan?
Oh, well, I would say as long as these tweets get collected by this blogger again, Taguchi.
Aya Watanabe, thanks for speaking with us. Very good to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Marco. Pleasure to speak with you.
I'll post a few more of Aya Watanabe's translated tweets at theworld.org/language, also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. And by the way, these tweets that have been collected, they've been translated now into 17 different languages. Now to the Middle East and the shifting sands, the shifting political sands, as the cliche goes. Just before we head to Egypt and the new language of satire there, let's briefly stop off somewhere where the government hasn't fallen or even retreated that much, despite some pretty big protests, and that is Syria. On the big show, we ran an interview with an American student from Middlebury College in Vermont. He was in Syria to study Arabic. His name is Teek Root. And the reason he made news was he was arrested at the site of a demonstration in Damascus. And then he was imprisoned for 15 days. He's been released. I'm not going to play the interview because it's not about language, but I'll post a link to it. And it's just a good reminder that studying a foreign language can get you into a lot of trouble, whether you're looking for it or not. It's also a little shout out to Middlebury College, which by all accounts has a fantastic language program. I really ought to do something about that in the pod, eh? Well, that's for another day. While the politics remain oppressive in Syria, it's a very different story in Egypt. Not that the protests are over or the questions over who exactly is running the country right now and what their intentions are, but some Egyptians are now looking at the lighter side of their revolution because there's a satirical program on YouTube. Of course there is. It's taking advantage of the growing online audiences in Egypt and this new spirit of freedom. Reporter Ursula Lindsay, who's based in Cairo, she sat in on a recent taping to find out what's so funny about autocratic rulers and their defenders.
A film crew is squeezed into an empty room in a high-rise in suburban Cairo. They're filming Bassem Youssef, 37-year-old heart surgeon, internet phenomenon, and let's just go ahead and say it, Egypt's Jon Stewart. Sitting at his desk with a phone, a laptop, and an air of mock seriousness, Youssef lampoons Egypt's TV talk show hosts and celebrity guests. His show started broadcasting 2 weeks ago on a YouTube channel. It has focused on some of the most egregious fear-mongering and propaganda on Egyptian state TV during the revolution. Youssef.
What happened in the revolution is unprecedented in the way that the media was handled. I mean, the extent and the magnitude of hypocrisy and misleading information never happened before and will not happen again. So that's why we have a lot of controversy. That's why we have a lot of material. It was a gold mine.
That gold mine includes, for example, this famous former actress complaining that because of the protests, she couldn't even get pizza delivered for her kids. That was before she accused the protesters of all being foreigners in disguise, who were trained to look like Egyptians. This is one time where Youssef finds himself at a loss for words. Or at least, words he feels comfortable putting on the internet.
I'm not into like the vendetta business. I just want them to stop lying to people.
Youssef's show makes the most of simple props, clever editing, and his own charismatic performance. While the filming takes place, Youssef's wife, Hala, tries not to grumble too much about half a dozen guys taking over her house. She says Youssef has always wanted to work in the media, and that he's always had a thing about Stewart.
When we first got married, he told me, "I want you to share this passion with me. I love Jon Stewart, and I love Steve Colbert, I think."
Youssef discovered the programs during his frequent work trips to the United States. He watches them online in Egypt. He'd fantasized about doing something similar here, but says before the revolution, there were too many red lines.
I mean, we're just doing 5 minutes. Jon Stewart has half an hour, he has celebrities, he has like his own cast of fake reporters and cameras. All we do it at home using YouTube material. But on Facebook and on Twitter and on the internet, people are already calling me the John Stewart of Egypt, which, wow. We are kind of like the ghetto version of John Stewart.
With his thin, chiseled face and gray hair, Yusuf even bears a resemblance to Stewart. He ends a lot of his sentences with the same high-pitched laugh.
If he was getting together...
There's a lot of laughing, teasing, and some arguing during the day-long shoot. In 2 weeks, Yusuf's show has gotten 500,000 hits. But in a country where only a quarter of the population uses the internet, he's still a niche phenomenon.
But the thing is, now I'm having offers of like TV show want to host me, and then it will be out. And I don't know how will people receive it, because in Egypt you never have something like that. You have people actually making sketches, putting costumes to like makeup to make them look like that person. But I'm actually saying their name, and I'm getting videos of them. I mean, I could be sued. I don't know.
He hopes his victims will have a sense of humor about it, and like the targets of Stewart and Colbert's satire, even come on his show. He also has another hope. You can probably guess what it is.
John Stewart, you're my hero. I'll come to New York anytime.
For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
I'll post a link to that show, one that comes with a translation into English. And that's it for this week. You can contact me or other listeners on Facebook and Twitter, or you can write me via email. The address is language@pri.org. See you next week.
Now I'll speak very clear for you, so there'll be no mistake. Not the one you spoke before. English is my language. It's the